Once more unto the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, to another exciting hour of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake McClure, usually with Jeff McClure, but I'm running solo today. If today is August 6th, 2016, then I am live and would love to hear from you. So if you would like to call in, the number in here to call is 254-773-1400. If you would like to talk about anything economic, anything financial, if you want to talk sports, then I'm not going to be able to be at all intelligent on the subject. So that's the update on sports. Now that we go on to the rest of news. The rest of the news. Okay, I talked about oil and trade and milk and cheese last hour. I want to talk a little bit more about some other things that are happening in the economy. In June, we just have this report that came out about consumer credit. It increased last month by about 6%. And that sounds like a bad thing. But it's the slowest rate of increase that we've seen in a very long time. And it's less than the pay increases over the same time period that's being measured. So people are making more money than they're increasing on their debt. And that debt, consumer debt, includes mortgages. It includes car purchases and other things in that line. It's not credit card debt. So it's a very good piece of news for the economy. And I realize that's a weird thing to bring up. What's going on there? Well, pay is up. Hiring is up. More people are working than were working before. More people are coming back into the workforce and being hired than were before. That means that income is up. People are willing to start spending. And as I said at the end of last hour, the engine of our economy is consumer spending. That's somewhere, depending on who the measure is, who's doing the measuring, it's somewhere between about 65% and 80% of our economy. I tend to think it's kind of somewhere in the middle in the 70% range. If that's such a big deal, why are earnings down elsewhere in the country? There are areas where earnings have been hit drastically. Some of the bank earnings are down. Why? I mean, they're still making profits. But why are earnings down in the bank world? This is a very good question. There are a lot of new regulations out there, a lot of them. There are a lot of regulations on banks, on insurance companies, on taxes, on many things. So something that's happened over a long period of time is we've had a slow creeping expansion of the tax code, and some may not call it slow. It's just in proportion to the massive amount we're adding it at a slow rate. If you try to keep up and read the tax code as it's being added, I think unless you're an incredible speed reader, you won't be able to keep up with the additions. That's really strange for me to say, that you can't read the tax code as fast as it's being added. Think about that for a moment. We have a really complex system already. What happens in the financials world when regulations get so overpowering that it starts cutting into productivity and to profits? If you have to hire people, lots of people, just to do the regulatory aspect of what you're doing to meet the standards imposed. Now, let me say something very, very clearly. Standards are necessary. Regulation is necessary. You don't want your bank to be able to foreclose on your house after one missed payment. You don't want the bank to have the authority to do a lot of things that the bank used to have the authority to do. So we've got regulations on the banks. We've got regulations on the big investment companies. These are good things. We want to make sure that they actually own a stock that they're selling you, or at least have it in their possession when they sell it to you, even if it's electronically. Regulations are vital. If you don't believe that, then try driving in Mexico City and then drive in Austin. While the traffic in Austin is pretty nasty, the rule following and the regulatory approach that we have save a lot of lives. A lot of lives. I have a friend from Thailand, and she had a baby here. So this beautiful baby girl. And on leaving the hospital with the baby, she talked about how America's the land of the free, and yet she's required to have a car seat in her car that's the specific kind of car seat, and that's facing the specific direction, and needs to have all the specific braces in place before she could even leave the hospital. They wouldn't allow her to leave otherwise because it's the law. And she said, I thought this was the land of the free. And I said, well, it's the land of the regulated free, because we've all agreed in our freedom that the high death rate of children in car accidents, or even minor car accidents for newborns, require us to put in some regulations. Now, part of that is market-driven. We tend to want to keep our babies safe anyway. But we've agreed, as a whole, as a group, in our normal election-type procedures, that we need car seats for infants in our cars, or you shouldn't be having an infant in your car. It's pretty simple. That's a regulation that most of us can agree with. Okay, how about wearing a helmet on a motorcycle? We're kind of ambivalent about that in Texas. We had a law for a while that said you had to wear a helmet. Now we have a law that says you don't have to wear a helmet. It goes back and forth. Why? Because the people that ride motorcycles are riding motorcycles for the thrill and the fun and the experience of it. And they know that they're taking their lives in their hands already. Because a helmet, while it might save you, if you're in a collision with a large car going high speed, you're not going to get saved. I don't care how good the helmet is. And that's just something that we've accepted. All right, there's some practices that we do that are going to be scary. The limit on regulation in motorcycles or infant car seats, the limit on regulation on banks, is going to waffle back and forth. If the banks can't make profits regularly, they'll go out of business or they'll be purchased by other banks and you'll lose a personal experience. If that's the case, and banks get fewer and fewer, we don't want that to happen because then they get bigger and bigger. And if one of them fails, our economy's in a lot of trouble. So we have a regulation there that says you can't combine banks above a certain size without a lot of oversight, and in some cases you just can't do it. All of that regulation is designed to keep consumers safe and to keep the interests of the market ahead of the interests of the leader in the market. If you recall back to the Microsoft Justice Department case, if people can remember that far back, Microsoft had the market share in operating systems. I think it was up at 96% of all operating systems out there were Microsoft. And Apple was barely hanging on. Steve Jobs was no longer on the scene. They were struggling. The Justice Department stepped in and said, we're going to limit you, Microsoft, because you're not being very competitive and you have so much market share that people really don't have a choice anymore. So they started actions. And Bill Gates did one of the most brilliant things in his life, though it was brilliant for multiple reasons. The main brilliance of the time was that it allowed him to continue to do business with Microsoft the way they had been. He bought $100 million of non-voting shares at Apple. They had to issue a new share class for him so that he could invest $100 million into a failing company. They used that $100 million to hire back Steve Jobs and to design the iPod, which led to the iPhone and the iPad and everything else that's made Apple big today. The Justice Department's insistence that there be competition worked really well, and it certainly benefited Bill Gates in that those non-voting shares were at the time a rare thing. Most people didn't think that they would have a lot of value to have a share that you couldn't vote. But that's how Alphabet does whole share classes, Google's parent company. It's how a lot of new companies do their whole share class, because non-voting means you get to own part of it, but you don't get an input on the actual running of the company. It's kind of an important feature there. So the first brilliant thing to Bill Gates there was that he was allowed to keep running his company. The second brilliant thing came a lot later in that $100 million went directly into the coffers of Apple, which allowed them to boost their revenue stream and the value of their company tremendously. And that $100 million is probably worth a lot more than that now, probably a factor of 10 or 15, which to Bill Gates is maybe not that big a deal, but to the rest of us might be a big deal. He did well there. Okay, so talking about competition in the market, talking about trade. I talked about that last hour. I'm going to talk about it more in the future. Consumer credit rising at a slow rate means that people are buying, but they're slowing down their purchases. That is a little dangerous going forward. So I've been talking about a lot of the good news, a lot of the things that are going well in the economy. There is a sentiment of fear because of the political campaign. This can be laid at Hillary Clinton's feet or laid at Donald Trump's feet or any of the other candidates before they were out of the race. Because the only way anybody can expect to be elected is to identify problems, complain about them, and then be the only solution. That's what has led to the mentality of the slower spending that's happening, not slowing down, but the growth in spending has slowed. So we're still growing, and we're growing fast. We're doing better than we were, but we're growing slower than we were the month before. Keeping that in mind, okay, earnings are down for financial companies. Regulations are up. And I'm going to give you, for your own gratification, some of the regulatory environment that we experience, all of us experience, if we live in the United States. We have a lot of different tax brackets now. Depending on how you count them, there's either 8 or 15 tax brackets. Well, wait a minute. What do you mean, depending on how you count them? Shouldn't a tax bracket be a tax bracket? Well, sort of. This is very confusing. Well, that's the tax code. We have tax brackets for different incomes. Then we have tax brackets for different incomes in corporations. And those tax brackets are not sane. They're not the slow graduating, getting higher tax brackets that we're used to in personal taxes. It doesn't go 10%, 15, 20, 28, whatever, like that. It goes 10, 28, 35, 28, 35, 28, 15. It's going all over the place. So which bracket are we in? If parts of your money are at the end of the money are in certain lower brackets than the middle part of your money, I think you can understand that just the concept of filing taxes has become a monumental task, and it doesn't need to be. If we weren't part of the system, if we were somehow coming in from another time and looking at this, it would make the term Byzantine seem simple. You know, that concept of the Byzantine Empire, because their bureaucracy was so big. Our bureaucracy is so much bigger than theirs, so far bigger. We have this new technology of computers, which allows us to get so complex for no apparent reason. And boy, are we taking advantage of it. If you're married, here's another great area of what tax bracket are you in. If you're married, your tax brackets are different than if you're not married, sometimes for the better and sometimes for the worse. A lot of times for the worse. Mortgage interest deductions go away for people when they combine their households if they're above a certain income, and it's not a very high income. There are a lot of issues that we have in our tax code, a lot of them, that are dragging the entire economy back. Last hour I said a good way to identify a bubble in the economy, anywhere. If you're talking about whether or not it's a good time to buy real estate or gold or any other thing. If you can ask this test and come out with a good result, it's a good time to invest. So, or a bad time to invest. So if an amateur can go and do it and in a very short time period make a profit, it's a bubble, almost by definition. Or it's a new technology. So Michael Dell came up with a new technology of custom making computers. He was an amateur. He started doing it. He made a profit. But it was a completely new area, new technology, new way of doing business. If you think about gold or real estate, you can have really, really brilliant people. I'm going to use real estate. A doctor and a wife. And I use this combination because people have recognized for a long time that a doctor and the wife now will say is an attorney. Both of those professions are extremely intellectually challenging. They buy a house. They paint the house. They sell the house for $50,000 more than they bought it for. They've never done construction in their life. They have none of that great brilliance in their brain devoted towards construction or painting skills. That's a bubble. They're an amateur. They're very smart amateurs, but they're an amateur. And if that continues, at some point it's going to crash. We saw that in 2007 and 2008. We're seeing spikes of it in specific places where in other parts of the country, when the real estate bubbles burst, people ran to places where the real estate bubble hadn't been that big. So they came to Texas in a lot of cases. And now we're having a real estate boom in Texas. We're seeing prices come way up in Austin, in Dallas, in Houston, way faster than other places in the country, which sets us up for the next fall. Now, it may not be this year. I don't see it being a big bubble yet, but if it continues, it will become a bubble. If you look at San Francisco, you've got another localized bubble, but it has to do with Apple and Google and all the other big tech companies starting there and paying their people a lot of money. Well, paying their people a lot of money makes that money worth less because all those people live in the same place. It just means that all the grocery stores jack up their prices. All of the real estate prices go way up. So paying them a lot of money to come to San Francisco, I've just had people that I was giving advice to accept executive jobs at a tech company in San Francisco. And I had to run an analysis for them to see if they were really getting a raise by going there because the cost of living goes up so much. And there's no really good figure on that. Localization of bubbles aren't the same because then we're depending on the revenue stream coming out of that. But if we're talking about real estate, a bubble's there. Now, let's use that same definition on tax preparation. What is the benefit to the economy or to the government from having a complex tax system? That's an easy question. It's an easy answer. There is no benefit to having a complex tax system. There's a benefit politically to individual people in the government who pass laws to make people feel good about getting a new deduction or a new credit. But if we just keep passing those laws and making new deductions and new credits and new tax brackets and saying this person deserves to pay more and this person deserves to pay less, we get a convoluted system like what we have. And it's going to get worse because the big rhetoric is not about simplifying the tax code. This is August 6th, and the number to call in here if you want to join this conversation is 254-773-1400. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. It's going to be a rerun August 13th. So if it's August 13th, don't call in. But if it's August 6th and you want to add to this, please call in 773-1400, 254-773-1400. The tax code, as complex as it is, benefits no one except the people that prepare taxes. Now, it's not their fault that we have a complex tax code. But every new law is actually the perpetual employment law for all tax preparers. Every new tax law that comes out means that they have more job security until we get fed up enough that we simplify it. It's not big on our list right now. Why? Well, because we just came through the great recession. It's taken us 10 years to get through it, and we're gasping now. And it may be time to stop and look around at the issues that are before us now instead of trying to solve the issues that happened 10 years ago. We've got those fairly well solved. In fact, the more we ratchet up the solving, we're creating a problem. If you tighten a nut too far, you break it. Well, you don't want it to slip. At the same time, you don't want it to break. And that's where we are right now. We're right on the edge of that. And I talked last week about the Laffer point, about raising taxes and you get lower revenue, or lowering taxes and you get lower revenue. And there's a point, and I'm quick, for those of you that didn't listen last week, shame on you, number one. Number two, if the government charges zero taxes, the government gets zero revenue. That's common sense. Slightly not common sense is if the government charges 100% taxes, also they get zero revenue because there's no incentive to work. You don't go to work if your government is going to take everything that you make. Just ask the Soviet Union on that one, or Cuba for that matter. If everything you make goes to the government doesn't get anything because you don't work, or you avoid paying taxes completely. There's a black market. So somewhere in the middle is the sweet spot, where if you raise the taxes just to that point, you get the best amount of revenue. Well, in economics, we watch that point move around every year. The economy changes, even sectors of the economy. The Laffer point is different if you're in construction than it is if you're in the tech world or if you're in real estate. All of those things have different influences. We have this convoluted tax code that makes it hard to figure out where the best tax position is for the revenue. So we have to come back to, there's an underlying misunderstanding as to the purpose of the tax code. The purpose of the tax code, as we see it, if the purpose is to bring in revenue to the government, then we're failing. We're failing horribly because it's too hard to tweak. It's too hard to make it work properly. If the purpose of the tax code is to allow politicians to give favors to specific groups, we're doing a great job. So let's just accept that that's the reason, and the byproduct of it is that we get some revenue. Who benefits from it? Even those little groups of people, otherwise known as special interests, but I warn people against that term because we're all special interests. My interests are not the same as yours, and if I talk to a congressperson about my interests, will they become a special interest immediately? All of us have special interests, so we tend to only call it special interests when it's somebody else's interest. All of us have wants, like the idea that you get a mortgage interest deduction is really cool. I guess if you're a true nerd, you think that mortgage interest deductions are cool. That's me, I guess. I would gladly see that disappear if we had a fairer, simpler system. But in doing so, we remove some of the power from the politicians, and they're the ones that have to pass the law. There's the big issue there. There are so many convolutions to this law. For instance, we get asked about gold all the time. What does gold have to do with tax regulation? Well, I'll tell you, the IRS doesn't look at gold as an investment. Even if you do, I don't look at it as an investment either. They look at it as a collector's item, like a trading card, like a baseball card or a Pokemon card for that matter. And when you sell it, they consider it the income bracket after 1 year. Instead of you go to capital gains, it's income, but it caps out at 28%. Okay, so what is that? Well, it's a collector's item, so it's taxed differently than a capital gains item, which is taxed differently than your Social Security, which is taxed differently, and so on. Because if I went through all the things that were taxed differently and that were subsidized differently or that were given credits or deductions differently, this is the convolution that we work with. If you're trying to start a business, just starting the business, a lot of people stop the process, don't start the business when they look at the complications they're going to have to deal with in taxes. It's insane that our tax code, not the level of taxes that we pay, that seems to be about right. And I know a lot of people would argue with me about that, but that back 2 years ago now, there's a new tax that was added to capital gains and to income for people above a certain income. It's the Affordable Care Act tax, the Obamacare tax, and it hit. I'm not a fan of it. It affected my clients directly. But it raised revenue to the government. If you raise taxes and revenue goes up, it means that if you lower taxes, revenue goes down. Now, let's compare that back to George W. Bush when he first came into office. He did some tax cuts. Revenue went up. We were above the Laffer point. The Laffer point, by the way, is named for Arthur Laffer. He's the one who put it together. He was the head of the Council of Economic Advisors to Ronald Reagan, and a very nice man, for that matter. His input into recognizing tax revenue seems common sense. There's a sweet point. We want taxes there, but the more complex we make the tax code, the harder it is to find the sweet spot. The harder it is to get the right revenue to the government, which makes our debt the only constant, the only known fact, because our revenue we don't know. And we have to pay the debt. We have to pay the interest on the debt. If we simplify the tax code, this is another piece that I want to get to, and I realize that Donald Trump is about to on the following Monday from today, which is the 8th, he's going to come out with an economic plan. His economic team has been divided. So if you're listening on the 13th, some of this may be dated. But this week, I did an analysis of the tax plans for Hillary Clinton and for Donald Trump. I used the Tax Policy Center, some of their data. But mostly, I did it on my own because they're trying to extrapolate into the future and unknown. We don't know what the economy is going to be in the future. All we know is what it is right now, and we don't know that very well. We know more about the past than we do about even the present, and we know very little about the future. I'm going to come back at the end of the commercial break to talk to you about the results of my analysis, and I'll explain it to you in a way that isn't boring or hard to follow. It's a bottom line issue, and it's one that all of us can understand, and we better understand it if we're going to be voting. So I'm going to play some commercials, and we'll be back. If you'd like to join me, the number to call in here is 254-773-1400, and I'll be back. And I'm back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure, and I left you hanging there. Said I did an analysis on the tax code proposals by both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. I'm going to precurse this. Precurse is a good thing to say about maybe just curse the tax code. But the tax code analysis that anyone does based on these tax concepts are going to be absolutely inaccurate. Mine, Tax Policy Center, anyone's. And when people talk about why is it that economists give these horrible, inaccurate things, I'll explain why. And I'll use either, you can apply this to either tax plan by either candidate. The tax plans are vague. They have to be vague, otherwise they get bogged down in details and the electorate can't understand them. Well, that tells you something right there. The fact that the tax code's too complex for the electorate to understand in a race means that we have a major problem. Okay, so I'm going to start with the Trump tax plan because there are parts of it that I like. People heard me say that. Donald Trump's tax plan, parts of it I like. He simplifies. Now, he's claiming that he's going to make it revenue neutral by, here's the place where the vagueness comes in. This is where it makes it really, 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 and keep saying really is indefinitely, hard to get a good analysis on a tax plan. He plans on making this revenue neutral. He's cutting taxes kind of across the board. Everybody gets their taxes cut, and the simplification on tax bracket happens. So everybody gets their tax cut. And the tax cuts are paid for by, get this, reducing or eliminating most deductions and loopholes available to the very rich. That's number one. What does that mean? What's a loophole? What's the very rich? There's no way to define that. If it's Donald Trump saying it, he may mean the ultra billionaires instead of the billionaires. Who is it that's going to be having their loopholes removed, and what are the loopholes that he's removing? Without that knowledge, it's almost impossible to do a really good analysis, no matter who you are. Number two, one-time deemed repatriation of corporate cash held overseas at a significantly discounted 10% tax rate. I love that. If we discount the corporate tax rate to allow Apple and Google and all the other big companies that are holding massive amounts of cash overseas that they would rather have here for internal investment, if we discount that, we're going to get tax revenue that we would not have gotten because they would not bring it back to pay that tax. That's cool. I like that. It's a great concept. If we discount it, let's make it forever, though. Let's say that if you pay taxes overseas and you earn the taxes overseas, when you bring it home, you shouldn't pay taxes on it. It's not money that required an American infrastructure or political setup to earn. Why should the American infrastructure and political setup get paid for something that I do in Ireland or that Google does in Ireland for that matter? And yes, there are some loopholes there. Yes, they have been used. The loopholes, I'm going to put air quotes around those, so just imagine them, air quotes around loopholes, because loopholes are in the tax law. Someone designed them. Maybe someone just saw a mistake and tried to use it. Those get fixed really fast, by the way. Mistakes get fixed. Loopholes are designed to be in there. And they're not really called loopholes to most of us, because most of us would not consider our mortgage interest deduction a loophole, except that you're not paying taxes by doing it. So only people that don't have mortgages would consider it a loophole. Oh, you're wealthy, so you have a loophole to not pay taxes on the interest that you're using on your mortgage. So loopholes, very vague term. The 10% tax rate on corporate stuff coming overseas, that's cool. We can have a measurement on that. What would happen if all the known cash is sitting there? What revenue boost would that be? Well, if it's a one-time event, which it says right here, it's a one-time event, which means that next year the drop in taxes doesn't have that one-time event to help offset it. It's very difficult to do any kind of analysis if we're vague and incomplete. So reducing or eliminating corporate loopholes that cater to special interests. Well, you know my opinion on special interests. We're all special interests when coming individually or in groups. So basically he says he's going to remove a bunch of loopholes that are made redundant because the tax has dropped. When I look at the tax code, and part of this is reasonable, part of it isn't. When I look at the tax code being proposed by Donald Trump, number one, simplification. I like that. Number two, dropping taxes across the board. I have a dual personality on this one. My dual personality says for me and for my clients, this is an amazing boom. If we can drop taxes, that's going to be fantastic. They'll have a lot more money. But revenue to the government will drop drastically. I talked before about that Laffer point. Just a couple of years ago, the Affordable Care Act, or the Obamacare Act, whichever you want to call it, added a 3% extra taxation on people that make more than $250,000. It added it to the capital gains rate, and it added it to the income rate. And revenue went up. If revenue goes up when you raise taxes, it will go down when you lower taxes. Not all the time, but in this short a time period, that's true. If you raise taxes and revenue drops, you've raised it above the sweet spot. You've gone too far. You need to lower the tax again. We're not there yet. If we just raise taxes and we got more revenue. So my split personality comes in here and says, we're going to have a lot more debt. So the analysis that I did, that's a napkin analysis that you can look at right there. Lower taxes and get a one-time boost of revenue by bringing money from overseas that are held by corporations, getting rid of some of the loopholes. I don't see that as revenue neutral unless you just completely strip out everything that was a loophole. But that's not what he said. He said loopholes for the very rich. Again, undefined. So if I were to just take what we know from this tax plan, just the tax brackets, and apply it to the last data we have from the IRS, and we say if we charge these taxes on data that we already have, that the IRS has already seen, and we know what the revenue was, we would drop the revenue to the government by hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. Depending on what loopholes got pulled out, I'm going to give it a broad range of somewhere between $400 billion and $1 trillion of lost revenue. It's a broad range. It's a big thing. Well, this analysis has to be broad because they're very vague. Okay, so we have a drop in revenue, that and spending's going up. So while he's making it revenue neutral, there's a lot of things that he has planned that are spending items. And if we drop taxes right before we spend, that was the error that George W. Bush made. He dropped taxes. Revenue went up, by the way, when he did that. The capital gains rate change caused a lot of people to sell things that they'd been holding for a long time. Revenue went up. But then we started spending money on the wars. I totally supported the wars at the time. Still do, to some extent, in that I don't believe in going back and second-guessing myself. With the knowledge we had, I supported it. So we spent money that we didn't have on the books to spend. We went into debt. If we do that again, only not in an emergency setting, where we lower taxes, which this time will not raise revenue, it will drop revenue. If we lower taxes, drop revenue, and increase spending while trying to keep it revenue neutral, all we're doing is completing a mess, making it worse. Okay, so let's talk about Hillary. Hillary Clinton, the big H. That's what she, what is that, the logo now is the H with the arrow in it. I'm not sure who designed it, but I don't think it's probably the best logo in the world. Okay, big H. She has a pretty simple change to the tax code. She wants to put a 4% extra taxation on people that make more than $10 million a year, which is pretty classist. It's basically saying none of you that are going to be electing me are going to be affected by this, so no big deal, and we'll raise the revenue. This is a very liberal concept. It will raise revenue, just not very much. There aren't very many people that make more than $10 million, and they're already taxed at a level that they're right at the Laffer point, too. You tax them too much more, and they're going to stop earning, or they're going to earn it in multiple years instead of one. Most of the people, by the way, this is something easy to grasp but hard to understand at the same time. Most people that make more than $10 million in a year do it one time in their life and never again. They sold a business, a ranch, they inherited something that they sold, something along those lines. Those people are the vast majority of the super wealthy that we hear about. They don't have a $10 million a year income every year. It's something that happens once or twice. And twice is pretty rare. The people that do it regularly are the ones that would be most affected by this, and they would lower their income. The people that sell a business and it's worth $10 million, if I were selling a business and it's worth $10 million and I already have an income and I'm going to have 4% tax rate above that, that becomes a large amount of money very quickly. If I have the option to sell it on December 28th and get half of it on December 28th and the other half on January 5th, so now I got $5 million 2 years in a row, again, we're talking about that tax plan's probably not going to be adding a whole lot of revenue. Those are simple solutions. When people are forced to pay a tax that they didn't have to do before, they're going to try to figure out some way to not do it legally. If they can't find a way to not do it legally in America, most of us pay it. But at some point, when the tax code gets too convoluted, some of us are going to stop paying it. And that's not what we want to see, because once that starts, it's really hard to reverse. We all agree right now that the government needs its revenue, that we need to have roads, and that we need to have law enforcement, and that we need to have defense, and we need to have Social Security, and we need all of the big things. All it takes is for the slow losing of trust in the system, and people will not want to pay. I mean, we already don't want to pay. You know, let's be serious here. We don't want to pay the taxes, but we're going to do it. And a lot of it is mandatory. An employer does it for us, or we get audited, or some reason. So at some point, though, if we're not careful, we become Greece, where nobody pays their taxes, and that's the norm. And even if you raise taxes, it doesn't change anything because people still don't pay their taxes. All right, so I've talked about taxes for Hillary and for Donald, the Donald and the H. The H and the Donald. Both of them are not good plans. I like Donald Trump's plan more, but it's still not a good plan. It may be better than the current one, but not for revenue purposes. For revenue purposes, it's worse. So let's figure out something truly revenue neutral. Let's make the tax code simpler. Let's talk about the loopholes or the deductions that get removed. Now, that's like touching the third rail, because you start removing those special interest things. The mortgage interest tax credit is one that's held by the largest group of special interest. And if somebody tells you you're not going to get that deduction anymore, everybody starts screaming. You shouldn't scream if the taxes are lowered enough that you didn't have to pay it to begin with. You shouldn't scream about it. You should be happy. So let's talk about what the politicians should be saying. Let's talk about a truly simplified tax code. Now, there's some pie-in-the-sky ideas. Pie-in-the-sky ideas that I happen to like. Really enjoy the idea of the fair tax, of a sales tax on things, very much like what Texas does. Only do it on a national level. We don't know what that would do, though, because we haven't had a national sales tax. So the transition would have to be very careful. And the politicians are not at all interested in doing it because they lose their power in doing it. They don't get to give special interest tax deductions. They don't get to say, hey, look what I brought home for you in tax cuts or tax breaks or special interest items. That's part of the way that they get elected now. So really it comes back to, we need to be careful about who we elect and even more careful about who we re-elect. And I've got a call on 773-1400. So caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Connor in Coppersville.
Hi.
You were talking about the taxes. I didn't know whether you heard this or not, but one of Hillary's speeches, I guess she was in North Carolina or Wisconsin or someplace, she was saying that somewhere in there toward the end of what she was saying about taxes, she said, and we're going to raise taxes on the middle class.
That was probably an error, because her written statement only says the only piece of tax that she has officially said.
Well, I think it's more like a slip of the tongue.
Well, yeah, both candidates do that regularly.
I think the slip of the tongue is because she really meant it.
I don't know if she really meant it or not, nor
well,
do you.
She may not have meant to say it, but I bet she meant it.
Well, that's going to probably mean that you're voting for Trump.
No.
Okay, well, if you believe that she meant it and she's not saying it in her official stuff, it was only on maybe one speech that you believe possibly happened?
Well, I mean, they repeated it several times. I noticed nobody else picked up on it.
Right.
Didn't even say it was an error.
Well, it probably was a slip of the tongue. Now, she wouldn't say that in an electric speech. She's smart enough to not.
Well,
if she's planning on doing it, she's smart enough to not do it. If she slipped of the tongue, she would say it was a slip of the tongue. The same's true on the Donald Trump side. If he says, I'm going to raise taxes on the middle class, he's going to say, whoa, even if he really plans on doing that, which I don't think he does. I don't think she does either.
Go ahead. Let me ask you a question. What do you think, what would, everybody talks about middle class, but what is the average, what would you consider a salary for middle class?
Okay, that depends on who you ask.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Right. They're just like many definitions we use, and I'm almost out of time, so I'm going to have to ask you to hang up and I'll talk while you're listening.
Okay.
Appreciate the call. Mm-hmm. We don't have a definition of the middle class. We have a rough estimate. Just like we don't really say what is a bear market, well, maybe it's when the market's down 10%, but maybe not. What's a recession? Well, maybe when we have 2 months in a row of, or 2 quarters in a row of recession, of negative growth. I like to call that shrinkage. The middle class tends to be somewhere around 50,000 to 250,000, somewhere in there. And it is the vast majority of us. It's the part that's grown the most. And I know that the liberals tend to say that the middle class is shrinking. But if you look at the people that have come out of the lower income area, that number has grown tremendously, which may mean that we have to redesignate what the middle class is, because the lower class has gotten so small. Anyway, I'm about out of time. If you would like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting on the weekends and live people during the week. Locally, it's 254-947-1111. Or you can call toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 1-800-914-PLAN. You can email me directly, jake@tpwc.com, as in thepersonalwealthcoach.com. You can email jeff@tpwc.com, and you can go to our webpage, tpwc.com. We've got podcasts. We've got our philosophy, and the newsletters that we do are up there. If you'd like to receive them, you can sign up there. It's free. We do deliver by email, though, not by mail. So until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.